have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by a beast I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. In the day, the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sheep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters, and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, have been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So we have Jacob's lashing out here against Laban, and what he says is pretty pretty true. It's pretty above board in the situation. Of course, he's not aware of the stolen idols, but as far as everything that he says, it is accurate. And Jacob's incredible success these 20 years, he says, has been because the God of my father is with me. By the God of my father, he's referring to the God of Isaac, the God of Abraham. Here he words it, the way he words it is fascinating about God. He calls him the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac. So it is the God that called Abraham, the God who Abraham heard, the God whom Isaac after him feared and served. This is Jacob's God. And he points out that if God hadn't been with me, surely I'd be empty-handed today. But these 20 years, you have afflicted me. These 20 years, you have dealt deceitfully with me. And, the fact that Jacob is walking away with a great deal of wealth and a great deal of servants and livestock and all of this, he attributes only to God. And I think that is an important aspect of his life and should be an important aspect of our life as well, that things don't come by the power of our own hands, but by the power of God. So in verse 43, Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, these children are my children, this flock is my flock." Well, that's not true, but he says, "All that you see is mine." Again, that's, this is very, he's being really dramatic about this. I understand these are his daughters and grandchildren, things like that, but, they had business contracts about the flock, as to what belonged to Jacob and what belonged to Laban. And Jacob hasn't stolen what belonged to Laban. He has only taken what belongs to him and what God has significantly blessed him with. So when Laban says, "All that you see here is mine," he's saying essentially, this all originated from me. This all originated out of my flock. But you can't say things like that, because the fact is this was business, and they had a contract. So he says, "But what can I do this day to these my daughters, or to their children whom they have borne? He says, "Now therefore come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Then Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones." And they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there on the heap. Laban called it Jagar Shahaduth, or Shahadutha. Excuse me, probably still didn't get it right. But Jacob called it the Leap. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, its name was called the Leap. Also, Mizpah, because he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you Jacob and Laban have had various agreements. And this agreement has to do with friendliness between the two, you know, families, Laban and Jacob. It has to do with a promise that that Jacob will do well to Laban's daughters and his grandchildren and these kinds of things, and that harm would not come to them, and that Jacob would not take more wives or anything like that. So this is all a part of this promise, and this gathering of stones there as a monument there for them. And notice they build this mount, right? This mount of stones, and they eat on top of it. And yeah, that's really significant. We see this throughout the biblical record. Is this anytime that a covenant is made, the two parties would sit down right there wherever they were, and they would eat. And it wasn't because they were hungry. It was a covenant meal. Very important. And, you know, the children of Israel, they did that. Moses and the elders of Israel, as they went up to the mountain in terms of the law of Moses, the old covenant, that is, they sat there down on the mountain there, and they partook of a meal. And so that covenant meal is very critical, as we see Jesus. The night he was betrayed, he took unleavened bread and he took fruit of the vine. And what did he say about the fruit of the vine? He said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." So he was having a covenant meal. They were sitting down and he was establishing a covenant meal. And so our recognition and practice of the Lord's Supper still to this day is a recognition of that covenant that we have between God because of the blood of Christ, the blood that shed to seal and put that covenant into force. So now we have an agreement, man, with God. We have an agreement because of Christ. And so we can have that relationship together. Well, this is what was going on here with this covenant just as well. And they have that covenant meal. It is a symbol of a togetherness, you know, sitting and having that meal. You know, because depending on our family, depending on our traditions nowadays, the idea of sitting down and having a meal might be very different. You know, it might be as simple as, you know, grabbing some fast food and sitting down at the TV or something like that. It's depending on your own practices and your own family traditions, it might be quite different. But in the olden times, it was very significant as to who was at the table, and certain people, you know, being at the table or not being at the table or not being allowed to be at the table, it had to do with the relationships that you have with them. And that's why when we see it in the New Testament, the concept of needing to withdraw from a disorderly brother, you know, withdraw from a brother in Christ who has turned to practice what is not right. That we have scriptures that say, you speak of that withdrawal and mention we're not to even eat with such a one, right? Not to even eat with such a one. And it's because of the concept of the relationship that is shared between two people who eat something together. So we're seeing the makings of some very original, very very old concepts of this covenant meal here in this text. In verse Laban said, Jacob, here is this heap. Before we go any further, go back to verse 47. So Laban calls this Jagar Shahad Dutha. It says, but Jacob called it Galeed. Isn't that interesting? So one calls it one thing, and it says, but, you know, Laban says this, but Jacob says this, and they mean, it means the same thing. What does it mean again?
Heap of witness.
Heap of witness, thank you. Heap of witness. It means the same thing. So what's the situation here? Well, one calls it one thing, the other calls it one thing, but the words mean the exact same thing. It's the same as us calling something, red in English, and someone speaking in Spanish would call it rojo, right? Is that right? I didn't roll my roll my tongue there, but that's what we're dealing with here, but this really strikes me as curious and fascinating, because what we have here is Laban. Now remember, these are family members. Laban's grandpa is Abraham's brother, right? So this is all the same family, and yet they speak two different languages. So Laban is speaking Chaldee, which is where Abraham originated from, right? Ur of the Chaldeans is where God called Abraham out. Well, Jacob here is speaking Hebrew. So he says Galeed. So it's the same thing, means the same thing. It's just two different languages here. But the origins of these languages, very challenging. You know, nobody knows exactly how old Hebrew is. Nobody knows who started with the Hebrew language, where it came from. Is it one of those languages that were born of God out of the Tower of Babel situation, where God had mixed up the languages of mankind there in that place? Is it one of those? So how did, you know, Abraham begin to adopt that? Because it's not where, you know, the Chaldeans, they didn't use it. It's interesting because, and if y'all been reading some of the bulletin articles, a few weeks back or so, I did several articles in a row on some things in the Hebrew language, and where I was pointing out how the Hebrew language is very nomadic in its concepts and in its pictographs, and this idea that these are not dwellers, these are not city dwellers, these are people who travel all their life. They travel. Well, those concepts that really begin with Abraham, not with the Chaldeans or anything like that. So I'm saying all these things, and I have no answers, for any of this, but. I do find it fascinating. As I said, no one actually knows when the Hebrew language was first spoken, or where it came from, or how Abraham had adopted it. But by the time we get to Jacob, we see Jacob using Hebrew, and we see that his own kinfolk back home, they are calling things by Chaldean language. So, anyway, it's fascinating to think about. Although we don't have any answers for it, but that's what we see going on here in the text. Two different languages.
These whole three or four chapters that we just covered here really combine together. If you go back to 28 with the letter, Jacob's letter, and I think you have here is two deceivers fighting against one another.
Yeah.
But at the end of 28, see, this is where he made a vow, Jacob made a vow to God. He said, if God will be with me in this way that I'm going, give me bread to eat, clothing for him, that I've come back to my father's house in peace. God had told him he was going to give him all these things.
Right.
So you had Laban who was upset because he had been beaten by a better deceiver, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, but although it took him 20 years to get what he was doing, but all, during all his 20 years, God was with him. God even told him, you know, he approached him and told him Laban would be coming after him. Then, when Laban started after him, he went to Laban and said, you be careful what you say to him. So God just played all this and guiding Jacob like he told him that he would do.
Absolutely. Yeah, excellent comment. So we're dealing with this grouping of texts that started with, these 20 years started with the idea that, as you said, you know, Esau was going to kill Jacob, so he flees. And so all these different things happen, but now we're coming back around full circle when we get to chapter 32, what's going to happen? But Jacob's coming back 20 years later, and him and Esau are going to meet again. And so we've got a complete a picture here in the text. So verse 31 again says, then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness and this pillar is a witness that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. And Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned to his place. So we find here, Laban talking about how the two families will do no harm to each other. And I want to focus here on the spiritual, of course. But, you know, notice what Laban says here, verse 53, when he says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. Think about that. God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God. So Nahor is Laban's grandpa, right? So Nahor and Abraham are brothers. But Laban says, the God of Abraham and the God of my grandfather, right, Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm seeing is that the God that Abraham served all his years was the God that entire family served. Now, Laban's got these household idols. I don't know. He obviously knows, as I mentioned before, he knows about the God of Abraham. But it's not just the God of Abraham. It was also the God of his grandfather. So where Laban has gone astray here with these household idols, I do not know. But at any rate, he points out that the God of Abraham and Nahor and of their father. So now we're dealing with Abraham's father. And so that it's not just Abraham. You know, it wasn't just that one day, all of a sudden, this brand newfound God, a God that Abraham had no awareness of whatsoever, calls him out of Ur of the Chaldeans. But that this is the God who called him is the God whom he served. If the God in that whole family serve seems to be what is being addressed here. Even Abraham's father had served this God. And so we have And this is family information here that we really would not know and did not know even earlier in the text, really. But you see, you know, this statement seems to solidify to me that why Abraham was so intent on, you know, wanting Isaac, you know, to marry back in that family's fold, and then even now with Jacob, where Isaac wanted Jacob to go back to the family, back to these individuals who know this one true God. When the Canaanites, they were absolutely wild and out of control, you know. And so, you know, Abraham didn't want any dealings with the Canaanites. And also, he didn't want anyone in the family marrying someone who's not a pilgrim, you know. He didn't want anyone marrying someone who was a true inhabitant of the land of Canaan. And so it was always go back and get someone who's going to be a pilgrim and a foreigner and a sojourner in this land, because that's who we are, and we are nomads waiting for the promises of God. We're tent dwellers here among all the city folk and cities around us in the land of Canaan. We are simple tent dwellers waiting for the promises of God. So it's all very fascinating information here in the text. All right, so we get to chapter 32. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Then Jacob saw them and said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And, you know, that little bit of information there is fascinating. That's all the details given. You know, now this is, you think a whole book could be written on this little bit of information, but we have you know, one or two sentences. So on the way back to meet Esau, the angels of God meet up with Jacob, and Jacob's response is simply this: "This is God's camp." Now, so this is really the first of the signs, if you will, the first message, you know, that God is sending to Jacob in this particularly special way, showing God's presence here and showing that God is with Jacob on this journey. Jacob has spent some of his days in fear and concern. And we'll see as chapter 32 develops, don't you think he has a whole lot of concern over meeting Esau? He's got a lot. He has a lot of anxiety over meeting Esau. And so it's fascinating that God is going to deal with him in this way, not just with showing him this is God's camp, that God is with him, that God will fight for him. But, of course, you know, everybody's favorite at the end of the chapter where Jacob wrestles with God. It's just incredible. Go ahead, Green.
Got a note here that says Mahanaim means two camps.
Yes.
Two camps, which were Jacob's evil camp and the encircling camp of God's mighty angels.
Absolutely. He calls the place two camps. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. So, God's camp, Jacob's camp, here they are, they meet up together, you know, and that's Jacob's concept here, is that as he is coming to meet Esau, we have this joining of two camps. And so, as I said, this is a sign that, God is with him. Of course, God is, has always said this. And remember last time that Jacob was in fear and he was alone and he was out there in the night 20 years ago. We had the Jacob's ladder, right? And God saying, I'm going to be with you. So now here he is again on this same trek of road, if you will. And he is struggling once again and in fears once again and these kinds of things. And now he sees, oh, you know, just like God had promised me long ago, he is with me. This is God's camp. So, in verse 3, then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we come to your brother, we came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two companies. He said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape. So we see the situation here. Very concerning. This is human nature. He's just peered in to seeing the presence of God before him. God's camp. It's so significant, he names the place. This is God's, Mahanaim. This is Mahanaim. And so as significant as this moment is, the second he receives some really bad news, Esau's coming after you with 400 men, he is back into full distress. I mean, what happened to the other camp? What happened to God's camp? That's human nature. That's how we do it. That's who we are, unfortunately. And, we get strength. And we read something from God's word, we're encouraged and strengthened by the brethren, and then, something happens, and all of a sudden our world's just turned upside down. We forgot everything that happened before. All right, anyway,